Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to What's the Schemata. Rob Brockman is here with me. Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm good, Chris. You know, today we've got something a little bit different for the listeners. You want to say a few things about it?
Yeah, look, as you may know, we have a course called a Schema Therapy Solution, and we do this with the lovely Wendy Beharry in the US. And a part of that, we have a Q&A session, basically, where we sort of get questions and sort of discuss that with the audience. So we thought it might be useful. A lot of these questions here are quite pertinent to a lot learning schema therapy, we know a bit about schema therapy. So, you know, this episode is really a part of the Q&A session, sort of asking and responding to questions from this program.
Yeah. Well, and also I think we finished the Q&A and sort of thought there was some really interesting stuff there, and I think might be really pertinent for a lot of the listeners engaging in schema work, and even those just thinking more broadly about the model and how to apply it might apply to everyone. So this is what we're going to be focusing on for this pod. It is a little bit different. So let's see how it goes.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Q&A session to the Schema Therapy Solution. We've got three different people in three different time zones. I'm Chris Hayes. I'm in Perth in the western part of Australia. I'm here with Wendy Beharry, who's in New Jersey. Is that where you're at?
Right? Today, I'm in New Jersey.
Yeah. And Rob, Mr. Rob Rock.
Yep. Over in Sydney, in eastern part of Eastern Australia.
Yes, excellent. So, look, when we developed these courses, we really wanted people to feel a little bit more connected to the presenters and to the people that are, you know, putting these kind of resources together for you, as opposed to having a book where you feel a little bit disconnected to the person who's writing the book. It has a little bit of a nice touch to be able to connect with you, the people that are taking on the course. So today really is about that. It's about, we've got a couple of questions we've got here, sort of bouncing off a couple of questions. Down at the bottom, there's a chat bar. Feel free to, you know, maybe add comments. We can sort of ask some questions on the fly as well, I'm assuming, guys.
Yeah, totally. If anyone has any particular questions, you're here live, right? So if you've got particular questions from the course or thinking about schemas and coping styles and all those things, pop them in the chat bar, and we'll do our best to get to as many questions as we can. We've got a few that have come filtered through already.
So, Rob, you got one. Let's bounce in the
lab. Okay. There's no time like now. So I've realized that my partner has a punitive parenting style, and this clashes with my parenting style, which is much more compassionate. How can I approach this issue that may affect the kids in the future? That is, if the needs aren't met. Mm-hmm. So I imagine, with this question, I guess you're in between a rock and a hard place, because you're trying to meet the needs of the kids. And if you understand schemas and core emotional needs, you become much more attuned to that. But also you're in a relationship, and a part of meeting the needs of the kids is to maintain stability in the relationship, to maintain harmony. So, there's a sort of balancing act there. So I wonder what you guys think.
I was thinking when I was looking at this question around sort of having a bit of a discussion point with your partner and be able to kind of sort of, I think something I'm taking from working with you, Wendy, is there's a difference between intention and impact. And this idea of, you know, a parent might have the intention of X and the impact is Y. And, you know, being able to kind of, you might have other schemas that kind of come into that play too, where you have to sort of talk about what your views and your beliefs are around parenting, and to be able to do that backstage. So I would be sort of suggesting sort that out backstage, sort of be able to educate and help and, you know, sort of help and sort of come to terms a little bit, meeting in the middle with your partner rather than front of house.
Not sort of putting your partner on show sort of thing.
Sort of like, you know, we need to talk about this backstage, but, you know, we don't need to talk about it in front of the kids, but we need to work out a way, which is, and the idea that we all, you know, we learn how to parent through modeling, and we know what we know, and that's, you know, and maybe from that particular person, they've come from that particular style. It's very normal and very natural to them and very familiar. So
I often think about that too, Chris. I mean, I always think about intention and impact. What is the effect? And does it match your intention? Parents usually come by this with good intentions, but the question we have to ask is, and maybe the partner might want to take a look at the course so they can both have a discussion based on the information that we're providing here, which is, you know, to see how do we best unburden our children from carrying these schemas. We can't protect them from everything, but, you know, keep them as unburdened as possible as their needs are being met. You know, you may not get exactly on the same page, but you want to get as close as possible to giving a message that feels cohesive for the sake of the child. And you know, really, again, looking at what is the price versus what is the gain in the end of these styles.
It seems also like one of the core techniques in schema therapy is something that we call empathic confrontation. And it sounds like that's really what it's about, is going backstage, as Chris says, and being able to pull your partner up in a very gentle way, in an empathic way that understands the frustrations, that understands where they're coming from, that understands the history and the intention, but also conveys that your belief that this is not going to work, that it's not going to have the impact that they hope for, and it could actually have a negative impact.
Yeah.
I think that draws me back to that key strategy that we use in schema therapy called empathic confrontation.
Hey, we've got a comment here from Murtachai. This is live, so hi, Murtachai, how are you? I'm wondering at what age, if there is any point in life when a person's considered to have their core emotional needs met. You guys, Wendy, do you want to comment on that?
Like they're met now and that's it for me.
Yeah, it's like, done. Pick it. Ow. Yeah.
You know, I don't know that there's a particular age. I think that, you know, since self-help and learning, or sometimes it's the good luck and the good fortune of being in the presence of a teacher, a mentor, a coach, an extended family member who may be the one who's actually fulfilling that need that wasn't met in the predominant primary home for the child. It may come with therapy later in life. I think the beauty of the model is that we see that it's never too late, you know, to be able to have those core needs met. We look at these schemas being formed based on unmet needs from birth through, you know, adolescence as being prime time for that to become kind of cemented into what we call the early maladaptive schemas. But, you know, then there comes along people who can kind of turn it around a little bit just by being able to meet the needs of that child in one way or another.
I think also to think that, you know, we're not going to get our needs met at all times, and our kids are not going to get their needs met at all times. And that's probably a good thing too, in terms of resilience and dealing with that. Mm. That's different kind of things that sort of happen in terms of sometimes the competition of needs, you know, and you have to kind of do some limit setting and, you know, thinking of others and things like that. But I guess in terms of even in couples work, you know, the whole idea in schema therapy is, are you getting your needs met? And often the schemas perpetuate that. So we're trying to kind of heal that to get, you know, that to change. And, you know, couples work, we might be trying to get people to work on their schemas and modes so they've got a better connection. They're getting their needs met. So it's a never-ending process.
I think it's a really good question. I think it's an interesting one. My first reaction is, I think that the needs are something that need to be met ongoingly, you know, that's to some degree, it's not sort of like I've done that now, that there's a quality of needs that they need to be fulfilled in some ongoing way. I think that's true in a lot of situations. I also would like to think of the other side of it, that there are situations where people might have a sense of fulfillment in their needs, in their stage of life. And I'm thinking of people like, I don't know, I'm thinking of people that might have been married you know, for 50 years and they get to 70 or 80 and their partner passes away. And the idea of trying to establish new intimacy would feel like, well, I don't know that I need that at this stage of my life. look, I want to focus on my friends and I want to go fishing and I want to do other things. I don't know that intimacy is something that I really need at this stage, having had a hell of a lot of it actually in my life. So
good question in terms of like the need that we have smooth through time, like a generational thing.
So they're my two thoughts. And I guess the other one is, I think we can decide, it's up to you to decide if you've had, to some degree, if you've had your fill. But you might find if you neglect a particular need, thinking that you've had enough of that, that it comes back, that if you don't socialize for 10 years, then even if you had a very sociable early 20s, that need might come back some stage and say, whoa, I'm actually feeling pretty isolated now.
Yeah, and we can't bypass two other things, which is that temperament plays a role, and schema therapy recognizes that we are kind of biologically engineered in certain ways to have greater or lesser needs when it comes to intimacies, emotionality, and touch and affection and all of that. I mean, there are some things that are kind of universal, but then you have those also. Point two is who have denied themselves the need. I mean, when I work with narcissists, they'll say, I never needed those things. Who needs emotions? Until they start to feel the fulfillment of getting that need met, and then the grieving process starts.
But that's also complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, very.
Another one here, got another one. Okay. So this is an interesting one. So it's something that I see a lot. So is all avoidance coping bad? So I guess we could kind of relate it to, avoidance or overcompensation or surrendering. I find myself avoiding things that are challenging. Is there a healthy way to avoid things? I guess you could say, is there a healthy way to cope with things?
I love this question. I love this question because I think it's really important to differentiate between when something is a problematic or self-defeating coping mode, as we would call it in schema therapy, like detaching, the detached protector. And when is it the healthy adult that's kind of leading the decision, consciously deciding that this is a good time to take a break, to step away, to distract yourself, to soothe yourself, to not be engaged in this. People living in trauma, dealing with a crisis, just living with a lot of stress or exhaustion, it might be a good time to not be so engaged in the emotional side of things. That might be a healthy decision. I think it's the difference between deliberate decision-making and what becomes kind of automatic switching into this detached mode where you're denied the right to your feelings because your feelings are seen as unimportant, not mattering.
There's almost like am I responding or am I reacting kind of idea. Is it like I'm reacting, I don't want to do it, no, rather than stopping and pausing and going, okay, well, I am reacting here. Or I am responding to this situation, because there is situations where I've thought distancing yourself from particular people or things, that's not a bad thing. If you've got a really difficult person in your life, got a difficult family member, it's not about kind of, okay, stop avoiding and sort of get in there and change things up. Maybe you need to distance yourself from those sort of people or situations. So that might be a healthy difference.
So I would say, yes, I think there's healthy avoidance and unhealthy avoidance. Mm-hmm. And then we have to ask ourselves the question, to tune into our healthy mode, is this a healthy thing to avoid? Is it healthy for me to avoid this toxic person at work? Mm-hmm. Or should I be persisting with trying to stay engaged with that person, et cetera? So I think there's a healthy and unhealthy avoidance.
What are you guys thinking about the other coping? What is there a healthy? I mean, obviously there are, but what would be your headspace around like a healthy overcompensation or healthy compliance? Is there any thoughts around that?
Yeah, you're looking at it.
Exactly, you're a healthy overcompensator.
come on, Wendy, what's a healthy overcompensation?
Oh my goodness, I'm going to get a
sense of control.
Now.
Like people like to have a sense of control, and maybe that's more of a leader, takes a sort of leadership role, I would imagine, overcompensation, maybe.
You think of healthy narcissism, there is such a concept. Those people in leadership who, they may be stomping around a lot and taking up a lot of space, but they're doing good and they're doing it for the benefit of others. So, and it's not so much about ego as it is about getting the job done. Mm. There's that. And I can think of times when surrendering, you know, just kind of giving in because it's not that costly. You're not giving up your soul. You're not selling it to the devil. to keep the peace, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a moment of peace. It's like healthy avoidance. You know, it's a moment peace. It's not about denying oneself one's rights. Right.
Yeah, like a team player kind of feel. Like, I just, you know, I'm part of a team. Okay. Sometimes it's, you know, there's a bigger battle. I'm going to pick my battles, that sort of idea.
But this is the beauty of, I guess, part of what we're trying to convey with the course. If you know your particular like go to, like if you know you're an avoider, if you know you've been surrendering, if you know you're an overcompensator, then you have to check yourself a bit and say, well, you know, I've got to become aware of times when maybe I'm overdoing it. And then, you know, can I get aware of those times? And what do I want to do to rebalance things a little bit? You know, to be a little more engaged, a little less avoidant, and or be a little less overcompensated, a little less in control, or that sort of thing. So, yeah, and in the model, actually, one way of thinking about this in schema therapy, you know, I actually think all of the coping styles are, you know, have healthy versions. You know, it's a bit controversial, but if you think about even something like, in schema therapy, we call this bully and attack coping.
Yeah.
Could you think of situations where that would be very useful to be able to display being very scary and aggressive and all those sort of things? There are moments in life where that might be functional, you know, and I'm thinking about.
Hopefully not too many moments.
Yeah, hopefully this is not your go-to.
Think of it as self-defense, certainly.
Totally. Yeah. Like I'm thinking about a situation where you're being robbed or you know, your kids are being hurt or something. Hmm. Being able to be in that sort of angry kind of mode might be useful. Hmm. So it's more about the regulation through the healthy side, you know, that these forms of coping are not automatic and broad and pervasive, taking over all of your coping attempts, but they go through that healthy sort of selection, you know, where you're asking yourself, is this healthy for me? Should I persist with this? Or is this the old pattern? Am I just automatically avoiding? Am I just automatically getting aggressive, et cetera?
Yeah.
That actually came up in one of the other questions. Maybe you can.
I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Perfect. Yeah.
One about sustaining anger, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be those one about sustaining anger. I think you've got a next one, Wendy.
Yeah, it's this. I like this because it reminds me of what we're talking about. Is it so bad to sustain an angry mode? I feel like I need to be angry at all the time, or I will simply give in and get hurt again by my betraying partner. This is a kind of phenomenological thing, I think, for a lot of people. A lot of folks, I think many people can identify with this, that when I'm angry, I feel strong. When I'm angry, I feel fierce. When I'm angry, I feel a sense of righteousness. Mm. I feel protected and safe in my anger. And if I give up my anger, then I might just become the doormat again. I might get stepped on. I might fall back into that old place of being used and abused. And I have to be angry. And I get that. And that makes sense. And it might actually be important for a little while to have that anger. But I think carrying it all the time is exhausting and not necessarily good for the body and the soul and the mind. And I think that being able to convert that into a state of just sturdiness, you know, sturdy, firm, conviction, resolute, you know, capable of being in this space can actually be sometimes a lot more threatening for a partner who is unwilling to change.
You see this as well in terms of people, you know, kind of feeling, having a history of being disempowered and subjugated and particularly disempowered, and then kind of being sort of on, you know, social networks, being sort of an activist, all this sort of stuff. And there's nothing wrong with being an activist.
Nothing against the activists, by the way.
It's more just, you know, where it might take away from other parts of your life and become a problem, you know, and that kind of situation of being outraged, there's an outrage sort of thing happening. And I think it's kind of it's probably like an overcompensation to feeling disempowered, but it becomes a problem. Yeah.
How do you think, I mean, just quickly, how, I guess it's always comes back to what's the problem with that coping style? So, you know, if your coping style is to be in a very like angry, irritable place with others as a way of keeping them in check, I mean, it doesn't sound like that's going to be healthy for your relationships in the long term, you know, for your partner, for your family, for your children. You know, so there would be some costs with that, you know, that you're feeling safer, you're feeling more in control, you're feeling, you know, more empowered. but maybe at the detriment of some things, people that you love and that sort of thing. So I think reflecting on that piece might be partly the motivation for curbing that a little bit, as you say. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, Rob, you got one? You got one?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right. So I've seen the word attunement used a lot in the context of parenting. How can I be a more attuned parent? Like, how do I do that?
I like that.
Over to you guys.
When I think of attunement, I immediately think of empathy. No surprise. But I think that big piece of attunement is really getting at eye level with your child and helping them to see themselves reflected through your acceptance, through your love, through your interest, your curiosity, your compassion. I want to know you. I want to know who you are. I want to know what makes you smile and giggle and laugh and cry and fear. I want to know what's important to you, what matters to you, your passion, your joy. Of course, you know, at a level that's relevant even to a three-year-old, you know, what seems to light them up, what makes them feel safe. Attuning is really creating that kind of bond in knowing. And I think that is such an easily unmet need, the sense of knowing. A lot of parents can be very loving and affectionate, but there isn't that real curiosity about knowing the child and having the child feel known, feel seen.
God, isn't it? It's got a sense of kind of like, he gets me, dad gets it, dad gets what's going on. Because you see teenagers and, you know, I've got, you know, sort of emerging teenage kids now and it's like, you don't get it, you don't understand. And that's that idea of kind of going, hold on, I do, I'm trying.
I'm a schema therapist.
At least I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to get it. But also I guess it's just trying to get it, but also there's like almost a headspace of actually stopping and dropping the phone or dropping the computer, I'm not dropping the computer, but yeah, dropping things and just noticing and being present. That's,
I don't know, you guys, how this shows up for me is, you know, I also have teenagers, you know, with your child and you can tell when something's off with them. And if you're, you know, unless they're jumping up and down and crying and stuff or being angry, you might think they're fine, you know, but if you realize that something's a bit off, just to ask the question, are you okay? You know, what's going on for you? Quite often you'll get, I'm fine, you know, sort of thing. That's often a sign for me that it's not fine. And I think you know the difference when you ask someone that question. So sometimes I just allow that space, not to interrogate them, but to say, you know, you sure? Because, you know, it seems like you're a little bit off today. If you've got anything to talk about, I'm always here for you. I really want to know you. I want to help you with that. So just to have that space available. And quite often, not all the time, sometimes they just go, I'm fine, I said, you know. And of course, you can't labor it. But quite often, if you hang in there a little bit, they'll eventually open up and say, well, you know, this thing happened or whatever. And then you get to co-regulate with them a bit. So that's what I
think. You're in the need bank account. And I guess this idea of like, you know, if you've got these kids and you're kind of trying to drop things to, you know, place some deposits in the need bank account. And a big part of that is attunement, you know, sort of it's hard to juggle things and sometimes just switching on attunement doesn't feel right because it's kind of like, hold on, like, you know, you're busy at work and suddenly you want to know me, you know, it's sort of dropping more deposits. Get some compound interest, and hopefully by the time they're in there.
And all kids are different, aren't they? I guess, you know, some kids are very willing to share things about their feelings, and other kids are either by nature or by learning or both more closed off or more seemingly more autonomous, more wanting to do it for themselves. Yeah. So it can be tricky to gauge like how involved you need to be. But
I think we can also offer a lot for our children from the schema therapy model in terms of them learning to understand their own modes. You know, one of the questions I will often ask my patients, and I used to ask this of my own daughter, she'd say, you know, I'm fine. I don't know. And I'd say, does all of you agree with that? All of you? Could there be a part of you that doesn't feel the same way? You know, it's just a gentle introduction to the idea that we are composed of many different parts or modes, if you will, different sides of ourselves that have different feelings. And it's a question I often ask, you know, with narcissists, of course, you know, that say, good, everything's good, I'm fine, I don't know why I'm here.
Is something wrong with you?
does all of you agree with that? All of you? Is there a part of you that might feel a little bit differently about this? And it sort of takes people aback a little bit for a moment, you know, gets them to think and reflect. Yeah. And kids love that question.
So it's like saying, you know, I know a part of you is fine because you can deal with this, but I'm also sensing there's another part of you maybe that's a little bit angry or frustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Giving permission to have another side, to have a feeling side. Yeah.
Exactly. Then you have to weigh the other feeling.
Got another one. Thanks. Thanks for the pass.
Over to you. Over to you.
Basketball passing theme today. I've been watching a lot of Olympic basketball, so I'm quite excited.
Last night was a tragedy. Okay.
Last night, yeah, the Australians lost against the Boomers. The Boomers lost against Serbia, which is a tragedy, especially when they're 25.
In overtime. Anyway.
Overtime. Yeah. Okay. What do I do if people around me appear to like the old me rather than the new self-aware version of myself? Guys. Yeah. Thoughts.
My initial thought is
everything
sounds
was
like
fine. My initial thought sounds like a therapist. Everything was fine until you saw the therapist.
And my initial thought when you were sacrificing
yourself all the time and giving in and subjugating yourself and keeping your mouth shut, not asking for anything and not complaining. That was great. Where's that old you?
Exactly.
I mean, part of me, the first thing I think is that sounds like a them problem. Yeah. In a big way, but I also understand for you, it might feel like a you problem because you're still dealing with the after effects of looking after yourself more, you know, meaning that you might be feeling bad about it. So I think we would have to address that, you know, the guilt that you might feel or the shame that you might feel about putting yourself first. And so, you know, I think you're going to have to deal with that in a certain way. And all I would say is that if I'm reading this right, it's okay. It's okay to look after yourself a bit more in this time of life. You know, you've probably been putting others first way too much, and try to let that idea, that feeling sink in that it's okay to have your own needs a little bit, to look after yourself. Sometimes with clients, I even say it's okay to be a little bit more selfish these days. You know, you've spent decades or, you know, years and years looking after
it. Self-interested, yeah. I call it. You've got to be self-interested. That's okay, right?
Yeah, I like the word selfish, Chris.
Well, just I think it's self-interested. That's what they say. It's the narrative. It's the schema where someone with the self-sacrifice says that they're selfish. And you go, well, you can be self-interested. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
But that's just as important, right?
I always overcompensate. I say, sure. I mean, it's okay to be a little bit selfish. You know, not all the way.
You need a little bit of narcissism. Just a little bit of item. A little bit more self-righteousness.
Yeah. But the hard thing, I guess, is tolerating the kickback. And, you know, I've got a supervisor that I meet, and he's got on his website, I know where my stuff stops and your stuff starts. And this idea of, you know, like sometimes when we change, it triggers other people off, or, you know, it might be different, it might change the system up. But I guess if you see it as something that's stopping your needs getting met, so for example, subjugation or self-sacrifice or emotional deprivation, these might be things that are kind of more, you know, impacting on other people. You know, it's okay to tolerate, and you're learning to tolerate that initial phases, because it takes time for people to get used to the new you, you know, and also it might be a part of the schema. The schema might say, don't like me. They don't like this. And it's like, well, you know, ask them, you know. Schema could be saying they don't like that, you know, me asking, you know, them to take more responsibility. And I'm like, well, is it the schema saying that? Rather than,
I mean, I do wonder about this. This is a bit of an effect of schema therapy, I think, if it's successful, is it can be a bit disruptive to relationships in a way, you know, that patterns have been in place for a very long time. All of a sudden you're acting in a different way, you know, I would say healthier way. You're trying to look a bit more after yourself, finding the balance. Maybe you're not surrendering as much as you used to. Maybe you're not avoiding as much as you used to. So that can be tough on the network, you know, your partners, et cetera. And I must say, I've seen on more than one occasion, people take stock of their relationships, you know, as well to think, you know, what relationships are actually healthy for me and things like that. So it can be tough.
And one of the things that happens is that, you know, the change does perpetuate some loss and grief, right? You end up in a position where you're no longer just defaulting into your relationships. You're choosing them. You're selecting them. And sometimes the people you have just, you know, you stuck around with these people because out of fear of losing and being alone, where now you're choosing as opposed to being afraid of losing. And it's very different, but there is loss there, and it can mean having to really kind of create a new collection of people or partner in your life that's just a healthier, better choice for you. But it's hard. It's a hard part of the process.
I've had people say things like, these probably other therapists call it a stock take. Like, I've done a bit of a stock take of my friendships, you know, and that kind of thing. So I think you don't have to go and blow everything up, but I think naturally you will start to think about what relationships are healthy and which you might want to let go of a little bit more.
Yeah.
Wendy, you got one there? You got another question there?
I do. I've got one. I really resonate with the self-sacrifice schema, and I find myself feeling guilty when I focus on me. So we've sort of described that. But I also feel resentful when there's no reciprocity in my relationship. How do I stop the battle between guilt and resentment? Anybody want to give it a start?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, like if you've got a avoidant or compliant coping style, it's back to this idea of, like, you know, taking, you know, sort of being a bit more healthy and coming up with a healthy response and not just responding to that. And, you know, unfortunately, it's about sort of taking a bit of responsibility for how you feel and your needs not getting met in the pattern. So sometimes I think, you know, you can have a lot of pent up resentment because of the coping. If you say, if you get self-sacrifice and you've suddenly always been the doormat and you kind of resent that, it's often because you haven't been asking for what you want and stating what you need. And this is sort of a build up, and it can be just, it's like kind of lime scale or kind of like built up over time, and it can flip, you know. So I guess,
but I feel so guilty when I think about myself. I feel so guilty.
So you're kind of stuck in the middle. But I guess this idea of taking responsibility of that and actually kind of sort of maybe doing a bit of an order of resentment, you know, kind of actually looking at that and actually sort of thinking about how can I start to sort of push against that concept. I mean, I think this is, you can't be sort of, it, you know, it's this idea of taking a bit more responsibility for the pattern. I think it's hard to take responsibility sometimes. I don't know about you guys.
This is the most common thing I see in people who are long-time self-sacrificers, is that they end up resenting those around them for, you know, that they sacrifice for, you know, because at the end of the day, no one is going to care the amount that you care. You know, if you're a self-sacrificer, you are really, really putting in, and then it only leads to disappointment because no one is going to give you back all of the things that you've been sacrificing. You know, that's the nature of self-sacrifice. You're the one putting in all the effort. So, I mean, I think the responsibility is on us. If you're aware of the pattern, you can reduce resentment by starting to look after yourself a little bit more and starting to have those boundaries. And then I think naturally you'll be resenting less. You know, you won't have as much to resent when you're not doing everything all the time for everyone. So I think that will happen when you slowly, if you heal this schema and you start having more balance and you're not self-sacrificing, I think the resentment would reduce. The big problem with this is it in doing that is being able to sit with or to regulate the guilt that would come up for you, the feeling that you're being selfish, the kind of thing we were talking about earlier. For many people, if you can't do that through the course, if the, you know, the strategies and the you know, the exercises that we've, and the educational stuff we've given you is not enough, it could be a sign that you benefit from some therapy focused on the self-sacrifice schema in particular.
Yeah, because this really pulls together the whole concept of the self-sacrifice schema. It really defines it beautifully in this question, which is, and some people come by it naturally, right? They have a tendency to be more sensitive to the needs of others. They automatically feel very badly, and sometimes it just feels intolerable to not be jumping in to take care of everyone. They feel so much guilt. It was modeled for them. There can be so many reasons and so many sources of where you learned that and how you developed this way of being. And I like to say that the resentment might just be reflective of that little you inside who's going, what about me? You know, what about my needs? What about me? And that's the beauty of reciprocity. It's hard. And as I think you said, Rob, if the strategies we offer in the course are not helpful enough, the little therapy may help to kind of push that forward.
Sorry, Chris, go for it, bud.
Oh, just a quick thing I was going to say is this the concept of the big cognitive concept, part of the model, you know, is cognitive components and is mind reading and emotional reasoning. So, he obviously thinks that I'm selfish, this idea, that we see a lot as therapists, my partner is making me angry. My partner is making me guilty. It's kind of like, your partner might be, but it's like there's you in there too, right? So it's your schema that might be interacting with your partner, and that's your responsibility. It goes back to that, where does my stuff stop and your stuff start?
The cool thing about this question too is that it shows the relationship between schemas. So in this case, we're focusing on that self-sacrifice. But it shows also that what's kind of sitting underneath that is a sense of emotional deprivation my needs aren't being met, and how those two things connect. And the more that you sort of sacrifice, the more that you maintain a sense of disconnection and that your needs aren't being met. So I say it's cool. It's also very painful the way that those two things are connecting. It's a good example, I guess, of some of the things we've been saying in the course.
Connect the dot even one more, Rob, right? You can go emotional deprivation underneath and a sense of defectiveness. I'm not worthy of getting my needs met. I'm not good enough. I have to take care of others because then I feel like a good person. So it can also be a stand-in. There can be...
For some, that's another connection. Yeah.
Another
connection. For sure. Yeah. And I guess then you're dealing with, there's so many feelings driving this sense that I have to sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm on point now. Okay, how are unrelenting standards different from failure? Aren't unrelenting standards healthy to some degree?
Yeah. So there's two questions here, really. Okay, so it's failure versus unrelenting standards. They can look very similar, but the way I kind of see it, the feeling, the emotions that are involved are a bit different. So failure, because that relates to me, I can relate to that. It's more about anxiety about my capacity, my competence, my skills, what I've got, right? So if I'm playing tennis and playing someone, I'm probably going to lose. I'm not that good at this. If I'm typing up something, I'm going to stuff this up. I'm not as good as Wendy and Rob, that kind of stuff. It's healed, right? But unrelenting standards is really about rules and it's stress. Okay. So it's a lot more stress based about kind of feeling like I should, must, ought, gotta kind of stuff. So often people that are overcompensating to failure, like I feel like an imposter, I don't know what I'm doing, they can work hard and work a lot, but it's based, driven by anxiety of not looking right, not performing. But unrelenting standards, you could be working hard, but it's more based on rules, and that's more of a stressful feeling. Mm. I don't know what you guys think. So
pressure. I always use the word pressure. It feels like pressure, like I should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I say that, but.
No, it feels like a demanding critic. Like it should be better. It should be finer. It should be straighter. It should be taller. It should be more beautiful. It's always, there's a should, and it can be a overcompensation for failure. It can be an overcompensation for defectiveness. It can be an overcompensation even for emotional deprivation, right? I'm not going to need anyone. I will be the best at what I do. I will need no one, and I will be autonomous. So it can be another way of trying to seek autonomy.
It's so interesting. If I could expand the discussion a little bit, because you make me think of, if you think about failure in the parenting context, and I've been noticing, with my own kids and being involved with kids, how much, it's really interesting how much temperament and even biology sort of play into our sense of competence about whether we can do things. And, so you take your kid to sport, tennis, whatever, basketball, dancing. And within the first sort of training, they're already forming this idea of, all those kids are better than me. I'm not good. I'm a failure. I don't want to do this anymore. Right. So already you've got to deal with this sense of like, I'm not up to scratch. with kids. And of course, now sometimes you take your kid to basketball and they're bigger than all the other kids. And so they have a good experience and they go, well, I'm going to keep going. But I guess it's what highlights for me also is, well, how do we regulate that with our kids? You know, do you just let them give up after one go at something? You know, how do you convey the idea that, well, you know, you're new at this and that's okay. You don't have to be Michael Jordan, you know? So I'll just expand the discussion to the parenting context. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I mean, I agree, Rob. I think that it's hard for kids, you know, the competitive spirit comes very naturally in those environments. But I do think still that the message is important and profound, and it may not take root immediately as your child is still developing among their peers. But I still think that we want to embed the message that you're fine, right? You're fine. And there's more to this than being the best. And yeah, it would be so cool to be the best. It would be like so great to be number one, but not everyone can be a number one, right? It takes a team to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And you're part of a team, you're part of a commitment, and you're doing a really beautiful job at being you, right? And that's just a message that we want to keep embedding, even though they may just say, ugh, you know, they may just toss it off as, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. But I do think it'll carry weight. You know, I think we don't want to talk them out of what they're feeling. You can join in that feeling and say, yeah, it would be so great to be like number one. Sure. It kind of stinks that you didn't play your best game today. I know it's disappointing.
But you tried your best. I always say, tried your best and you left it on the court, you know.
And I enjoyed watching you play. I love watching that
kind of thing. So much fun to watch you play. It's so much fun to watch you.
So we want to get away from this binary, you know, fail, achieve idea and focus more on the process and on trying your best and taking other things for out of it, you know, being a part of a team, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, if they win the grand final, you have a party. And you say, well, that was really cool too.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got a question from someone in the chat. Oh, sorry, to synthesize this a little bit.
I see some things in the chat too.
Yeah. So someone is running up saying, look, I feel like I've got an entitlement schema that I've got from not getting my needs met in early childhood, and I'm working to reduce the power of this. In conversation, I find myself getting anxious when I sense that I'm being misunderstood. I notice that if someone responds to me to something that I'm not meaning, I feel impatient and a sense of entitlement to be heard and understood before responding to other people's question. How might you approach slowing down this trigger, and how might the healthy adult mode, what it might sound like here in a sense? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if this is the case, but this is not uncommon with a strong deprivation of empathy schema. So when you haven't really been seen and known and understood and really held in the mind of another in that way that we all so long for from the time we're very little, when you don't have that, people are sort of, you know, attaching a meaning to something you're saying and it's not what you mean, but they think they know you and they don't really know you. And it can be, if you have that schema, it's very triggering. Your healthy adult would need to be able to step in so you can hear yourself saying these two words, which are really critical, these two words, of course, right? Give some empathy to yourself. And of course, I'm frustrated with this. Of course, I'm impatient with this. Of course, I'm saddened by this. All my life, I've longed for someone to know me and understand me. And it's so hard for me to be able to get that, either in the way I'm conveying it or the way they're hearing it or the prescribed notions that people have about us. So the slowing down has to start with first being patient with yourself about that, you know, having empathy for the fact that you're missing this empathy. You've missed it maybe your whole life, if I'm right, if that's part of what your experience has been.
It's a good question. I mean, in the terms of other people might say you're being entitled, but it might not really come from a place of entitlement. It might actually be just deprivation, this sense of kind of, if your radar is really set high to not mattering and not being a priority because of your pain, and that's very familiar, then there's going to be a lot of false positives and reactions to things, and maybe jumping to that, you know, really, really quick, you know, because it's kind of like, if that feels like not mattering, bang, And I guess that's the hard thing, is that sometimes having a bit of goodwill around the people around you, you know, that you know, we're not always going to get it. You know, we could be good friends and have good family, and you know, I'm certainly trying my best. But we as therapists as well, we try really hard. We often have reactions where we don't get it exactly, and we get very big responses from the clients we work with. So, you know, just reminding that, you know, there are people around us. It's not like now, people can and are open to hearing us and seeing us, and some of it's old stuff too. You know, Rob, you.
I just think it must be so painful, because we can all be so ignorant in different ways and make assumptions and things. So I imagine this one would come up fairly often, that you speak to a human and then you get the idea that they don't get it. So I just wanted to empathize there, you know, that it must be tough. But yeah, it does feel also like one of those ones that might be good for therapy, for your own therapy as well. I don't know, if you say 10 years, I imagine you're a schema therapist yourself. So it's one of those ones, I think, that might be good for a little bit of your own work.
And also to think that the entitlement may not be so much entitlement as it is a little you who's angry, you know, in the moment. Yeah. So when you say, what can I do from my healthy adult perspective? Again, I'd say, you know, like, be patient, be kind to yourself, recognize that this frustration is probably very old and it's hurting and there's a longing, and it will require maybe a couple of extra steps to help someone to really know what it is you're trying to express.
So the difference between entitlement and emotional deprivation in this context would be, the backgrounds would be very different. One would be based on, I mean, I guess you can get that mix, but, you know, I'd certainly remember someone who, you know, presented in a work setting, and someone was saying, this person's very entitled. And when I met them, I was like, you're not really entitled. This person doesn't look like someone who has had no rules and, you know, sort of like no accountability, and, you know, he hasn't been the special boy. This probably person has had nothing. And the person was like, well, he's being very entitled about XYZ. And I'm like, well, he's not being entitled. He's just got strong deprivation. He feels as invisible. And that's the way he copes with that, and fight for.
I guess it's the difference between, like, we call secondary entitlement and primary entitlement and these kind of ideas. Yeah.
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 Secondary entitlement coming from a place of pain. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So who's next? We've got a couple more. Also a reminder to guys tuning in, we'd really love to answer some live questions too. We hope that helped it on some ways, Julie. Julie's saying that is spot on, strong lacking in the emotional deprivation scheme. I see. Wendy, mm-hmm. Wendy's very tuned. She picked it up. So guys, we'd love to hear a couple more questions come through live. What are the ones we have, guys?
We have a question. Grew up with narcissistic parents, and I know enough about the pain endured in these relationships. Why do I continue to gravitate toward narcissistic partners in my adult life? And I've heard this before, like, am I a masochist? What's wrong with me? I should know better. I lived with this, and I keep going for these partners. What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm. Familiarity? You know, I think the thing is that when you've got someone who's familiar, it's safer, and you kind of have an expectation, and suddenly you have someone that's, you know, attuned and asking what you want, and that can be very unfamiliar. And in some ways, that, you know, sort of, if you've got someone who's probably good for you, it's sometimes we talk about emotional deprivation and needs getting met is like emotional nutrients. Sometimes having those emotional nutrients, it's like eating, you know, greens as kids, like you're eating broccoli. It kind of feels weird. It's uncomfortable. It tastes strange. It looks weird, but it's kind of getting used to having those needs met. So sometimes it's familiarity, and it's kind of like, oh, well, I'm just going to stick to eating pasta and rice and all these extra things here that are meant to be good for me. I'm not sure about that. So
there's a cool term for this in schema language, which is schema chemistry. So maybe that's the point of view we can explore a bit more, that which is that, not all of us, but many, many of us tend to have certain patterns in our relationships that reflect our early need profile, our particular schemas and coping styles. So the first thing I'd say is, be kind to yourself, because you're just a human being and you're getting involved in schema chemistry. I think that's the first step, is to understand the pattern, you know, from a position of chemistry, and be kind to yourself about that.
Yeah.
Wendy, you have something else to add?
I mean, well, the other thing to think about is, when you grow up with narcissistic parents or any kind of parent who is not meeting your needs, ask yourself the question, what did I learn about me? It's not, you know, it's this, how could I gravitate towards a narcissist? I grew up with narcissists. I grew up with parents who were depriving or neglectful. And I said, but what did you learn about yourself from those experiences? It makes sense, doesn't it? That if you, what you learned is that you don't matter. You don't have rights. You're not good enough. You're not lovable. You don't deserve attention, right? That it's all on you to carry the ball, to carry the weight, to make things work, to make things happen, to perform, to do. If that's what you learned, then wow, doesn't it make sense that the perfect dysfunctional partner for you is a narcissist, someone who's going to repeat that same pattern because that's what you were taught about yourself. So it's really about unlearning. I mean, that's what we're doing in this course. We are learning and we are unlearning those patterns. We are trying to, you know, kind of replace some of these ideas with more accurate appreciation for ourselves, meeting needs for ourselves, so that it's, you're not carrying around the same idea that you're not deserving.
And the thing too, you know more than many, Wendy, with those with a narcissistic pattern, is they don't always present with the sort of toxic side of that, of course, right? When they meet you, of course, you only get the charming side.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense why you might get involved with people. On top of the scheme of chemistry, you've now got someone who's very charming and who seemingly can, you know, flatter you and meet your needs and things, and you don't see the toxic part until later.
Mm. Yep.
But to sort of to wrap that up, I guess, you know, what I often talk about in therapy with folks is, you know, if knowing all this about yourself now and understanding the pattern is to start to think intentionally about, I mean, depending on your age, depending on your situation in life, you know, what kind of relationship you do want? What have you learned so far from this? And if you were to break the pattern, I mean, it probably wouldn't be the opposite. You don't want to maybe go and find someone who's completely selfless and all those things. Maybe that would be too strange for you. But, you know, can you have a bit more of a, again, we use the word stock take on if you're intentionally going to choose a partner and what would it look like? And one little piece I do a lot of in my schema work, I would call partner selection. Like often folks that come for schema work have issues in partner selection where for whatever reason, they're repeating the same pattern. They're sort of not breaking the pattern of, you know, partner selection issues. What do you think, Wendy? Do you think about it in that way, that there are often folks with a specific issues in partner selection that they repeat the patterns?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes it's because it's too much attention being focused on the partner and not enough attention being focused on how am I showing up when I meet someone? How do I show up? You know, it's, I say, put your eyes on yourself. This is a discovery mission. It's not a discovery mission that's based on who is this person in front of me. Yeah, you're going to pay attention to that attraction and all that, but you need to be paying attention to yourself. Oops, I said yes again. I didn't really agree, but I gave in. Oh, I did. I continue to let this person interrupt me. Oh, I'm not really sharing much about myself. You know, notice yourself doing things that you don't yet you want to stop doing, the things that hurt you, the patterns that have been so self-defeating. Watch yourself. I think in partner selection, we pay too much attention to watching the other and not
That's
watching
really
yourself.
Good point. That's a really good point. Yeah, taking stock of ourselves as well in those in that situation.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, we hope you're enjoying the course and we'll see you around.
See you later, everyone.
See you guys.
Bye, everybody.